From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. Fifty-eight refugees detained by Australia on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island flew out of Port Moresby on Tuesday for resettlement in the United States. They left as part of a deal struck between Canberra and Washington in November 2016 for America to take up to 1,250 refugees from Australian Offshore Detention Centre on Manus and Nauru. 130 refugees from Nauru are due to join them next month after the first group of about 50 were resettled in the U.S. last September. Ben Robinson Drawbridge spoke to Amy Froh from Australia's Human Rights Law Centre after more than 40 men left PNG on Tuesday morning.
Good news for about, we understand, 40 men who flew out this morning applying to their freedom in the U.S. But not so good news for the 2,000 men, women and children that have been kept on Manus Island and Nauru for the last 4.5 years, unfortunately. They're still stuck there with no timeline and losing hope rapidly that they'll have a future.
Speaking of losing hope, the United Nations recently observed that their situation was becoming increasingly hopeless.
Yeah, that's right. So the UNHCR released a report over the weekend saying that the situation in Manus, men are hopeless and helpless there. You'll probably recall that the detention centre was closed and the men forcibly removed in about mid-November last year. And since then, they've been moved into what the UNHCR has been ongoingly describing as unsuitable and really unsafe accommodation.
So we know the United States has agreed to take some men, but why is it taking so long?
That's the million-dollar question. It's been over a year now since the deal was first released. We saw 54 people from both Manus and Nauru going last year at the end of September, and we've seen another 40 go today. Given that over 1,600 people have expressed interest in going and the UNHCR has endorsed over 1,200 people, to only have what I understand is about 4% of the people actually gone after over a year is really disappointing, and people are rapidly losing hope that they'll find the safety that they sought nearly 5 years ago now.
And it's clear that they won't all go to the US. So what's being done about finding solutions for these people?
Not enough. Yeah, we've heard reports that about 1,250 people are likely to go to the US maximum. There's nearly 1,800 people at this point who've been found to be refugees, so technically eligible for resettlement. But at this point, no other solution seemed to have been found. I know your government in New Zealand has offered to take 150, and at this point Australia is strongly resisting that. I think it's terrible that 150 people could be living in safety at this moment in the generosity of the New Zealand government, and we would really call on our politicians to do the right thing and make sure people are safe as soon as possible.
We're hearing reports, though, that people smugglers are still trying to ship displaced people to Australia. So what does that say about this whole policy of offshore detention and the deterrent it's meant to set up?
When you have really, really desperate people fleeing really dangerous conditions, they'll continue to do so until a safe solution is found. These people, there's no safe way for them to get where they can rebuild their lives, and that's why I think there'll always be risks of people seeking safety until a solution is found where people can be, in an orderly and safe method, find a new place to live.
A 6-year-old Papua New Guinea girl who was tortured for allegedly using sorcery is to be given protection for the rest of her life. The girl was brutally tortured by several men in Enga province when a small team who worked to counter sorcery-related attacks in PNG rescued her. She was flown to Port Moresby to receive medical treatment for wounds and burns sustained all over her body from heat bush knives. The girl's mother has been burned alive in a public market in Mount Hagen in 2013 after being accused of using sorcery. Among the team that rescued the girl in November was the Lutheran missionary Anton Lutz. He told Johnny Blaze that while it's known who the girl's torturers are, they have not been arrested.
There's photographs of the torturers and their names, and those are known to the police, and yet they have not been arrested. It's very difficult for the police to have the adequate manpower and resourcing to go in there and deal with the community that vastly outnumbers them, perhaps outguns them as well, and is not interested in surrendering their suspect.
So that's the case with the torturers of that six-year-old girl, that it's sort of known who the people were, but the police can't act on it in this case because they would be outnumbered?
Well, that may be one of the reasons. They may also have other reasons that they're unable to effect those arrests at this time. I have not spoken with them about that recently, but I do know that all the police in Anga could go to that village and they would still be outnumbered.
How is she? Do you know?
She's doing all right. She's doing well. Better than we should be able to expect. I'm not sure where her eventual home will be, if it will even be in PNG. But she will be protected for the rest of her life, and we will keep her identity a secret. And hope that she's able to live a full life.
Who's doing the protecting?
Well, at this point, the State Protection Services are involved, and they've put her at a placement and so on. So there's, you know, we have policies and so on with all of that. So I'm not sure where she is actually at the moment, but she's being looked after in the child welfare system.
And does she have a father or some caregivers from her own family?
Not from her immediate family, no.
The earlier attack in 2013 was in Western Highlands. Did she have to move after that, or they were on the move at the time?
Monthagen. Right. So the way that went down was the mother and father and this, she was just a toddler at the time, were in the house when the mob came, and the father grabbed the daughter and ran and survived, and the mother was killed. And so he took the girl to his home village and raised her there, and she was then attacked at the age of six in her father's home village in Pennsylvania.
Is this what happens, that it goes on, it extends to family members of the accused, yeah?
Yep, yep. And this is the hidden side of this crisis, is that for every allegation or accusation or attack that we see, it affects children, it affects siblings, it affects parents, and the entire family can become ostracized within their own community and become complete outcasts. And this will go on for generations unless rule of law is reestablished and people become educated away from these beliefs. We don't simply rescue one woman. We have to then rescue her children, and then we have to then rescue their children. And, you know, it's just going to be decades of work trying to get these people to safety, where the communities would just happily torture them to death.
Fears have been raised in French Polynesia that the French nuclear weapons test may have triggered genetic and hereditary changes among the people exposed to the blast. Until less than a decade ago, France claimed that its 193 tests at Maroro and Fantaufa were clean and had no impact on human health. An article published in France at the weekend has revived the debate about the test legacy. Walter Zweifel reports.
A French child psychiatrist has told the paper Le Parisien that during his time in Tahiti, he treated 271 children for pervasive developmental disorders. Dr. Christian Sueur said 69 of them had developed disorders or intellectual disabilities, which he attributed to genetic mutations. For the test veterans organization Mururu et Tato, the revelations are nothing new. Its head Roland Aldum says the signs are worrying.
I've been to Turia, where in one family you have 7 to 9 people having cancer in the same family through 3 generations, I mean grandparent, the parent, and the children.
Dr. Sueur, who had been in charge of child psychiatry at Tahiti Hospital until the end of last year, says it has been established that a quarter of the children who were on Turia during the 1971 blast now have thyroid cancer. He told French TV that care on small atolls near Mururoa is poor.
In this area, in the south of the Tuamotus, the Public Health Service of French Polynesia shows little interest and doesn't even go to some atolls, so there are just military doctors.
His study, which has now been published in its entirety online, likens the situation for French Polynesia's victims to those of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. Yolande Vernodon, who is the new head of the French Polynesian Commission looking at the test legacy, was dismissive of the report in an interview with Tahiti's Radio 1.
No, this is not a scientific document in its proper sense. It's a report of a doctor, of a psychiatrist, who dealt with sick people as it was his job.
Roland Oldham says the official response to date has been insulting to both his organisation and the experts who have been on the case. He says too many are stuck in what he calls a colonial mindset.
The situation has not changed in the fact that this policy of hiding the truth, not only from the French government, but from our own government.
Father Auguste Weber-Carlson of Association 193, which assists test victims trying to get compensation for radiation-induced illnesses, told local media that the lack of response is no surprise.
In this country there is an omerta, a code of silence, and fear of the French state, which is still highly present.
Dr. Sueur has seen troubled and deformed children and is trying to establish the reasons for their condition.
It's important that studies are being carried out by independent people, by doctors, researchers, epidemiologists, geneticists who could come from France or even from abroad to guarantee independence in this kind of matters.
The debate coincides with a visit of the French Overseas Minister Annick Girardin, who is this week due to launch a committee to set up an archive on the legacy of the French nuclear weapons tests. This is Walter Zweifel.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Well, we're already towards the end of January, and 2018 will bring several elections to the Pacific, an independence referendum, and a major range of other global events. Here's Jamie Tahana with what's lingering on the horizon for 2018.
Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama has pledged to redouble his efforts on the international stage as he continues his campaign for action on climate change. But he will have plenty of work on his hands domestically this year. Sally Round has more.
Two coup leaders will go head-to-head in the Fiji election due to take place this year. It's the second election since the 2006 coup. Polling day is yet to be announced, but political parties and election authorities have moved up a gear in preparation. The incumbent Prime Minister and 2006 coup leader, Frank Bainimarama, will be hoping kudos gained as an international climate warrior will send votes his way back home. Facing him, another former military man and leader of Fiji's first coup, Sitiveni Rambuka, who's made a political comeback leading SADELPA, the biggest opposition party in parliament. The opposition bloc has made little headway in Fiji's newly fashioned parliament against the numerical might of Mr. Bainimarama's Fiji First Party, but a shuffling of the cards, including some notable defections from the government, could boost the opposition's chances this time round. Meanwhile, a dispute involving 200 ground staff at the main international airport is casting a shadow over Fiji's all-important tourism sector, and the government will be hoping to contain the fallout to ensure its chances at the ballot box.
In New Caledonia, the French territory's economy hopes to recover with a rising nickel price and avert massive job losses as Vale ponders the future of its plant. Here's Walter Zweifel.
Adding widely felt concern about burgeoning youth crime, the territory is entering its most pivotal year in more than a generation with apprehension about its future. A referendum on full sovereignty will have to be held by November to complete a 20-year decolonization process that has shifted a raft of powers from Paris to Noumea. Voters will have to decide whether to stay within the French judicial, security and monetary systems or whether to go it alone and become the Pacific's first independent country this century.
2018 is also a big year for Papua New Guinea, which is to host the APEC Leaders Summit in November. The summit is a massive undertaking, with leaders from 21 Asia-Pacific countries, including the United States and China, expected to descend upon Port Moresby. Here's Johnny Blades.
The Peter O'Neill-led government has been preparing to host APEC for several years and argues it will help put PNG on the map for global investment and trade. But while it allocated $90 million in this year's budget for hosting the event, the International Monetary Fund estimates PNG will have to spend billions on APEC. For a country in as tight a fiscal position as PNG has started 2018 in, this means others will have to stump up. Neighbours Australia, New Zealand and Indonesia are stepping in to help foot the bill for APEC and bolster PNG's security capabilities. Security is a leading concern because, as shown in recent months, law and order shortfalls, domestic violence, sorcery-related attacks and abuses by police remain huge problems for PNG. APEC will be the biggest event it's ever hosted, but the jury is still out on whether PNG's people will benefit from it.
In Tonga, Akilisi Poheva was sworn in last week to continue his reign as Prime Minister, despite last year's dissolution of Parliament by King Tupou VI. Kurovaka Uta has more.
2018 sees Akilisi Poheva continue his reign as Prime Minister of Tonga, despite last year's dissolution of Parliament by King Tupou VI. The King's move led to the November snap election and came after concerns were raised about the conduct of the previous Poheva government. This means this year all eyes will be on how the administration performs during the start of its second consecutive term. Attention will also be on the health of Mr. Poheva as the 76-year-old began the year in the local intensive care unit, missing the opening of Parliament but returning for the first sitting of the House where he was sworn in. Local media have complained about the lack of information that surrounded Mr. Poheva's health, and coming off last year's controversial comments and staff changes at the state broadcaster, there'll be no doubt further scrutiny of government relationships with the media. The Poheva government has promised to operate in the same manner, so interesting times are ahead in the kingdom.
And finally in Solomon Islands, which has an election looming amid reports of more political instability. Here's Karoi Hawkins.
It has only been 2 months since the last Prime Minister, Manasseh Songovare, was ousted through a motion of no confidence, and just last week, new reports emerged of an internal plot to overthrow the government of the new Prime Minister, Rick Ho. 2018 will also be the country's first without the presence of the Regional Assistance Mission, which left in June last year after 14 years of peacekeeping and nation-building in the wake of a bloody civil war. This year, the national elections are also due, although some local media report they could be delayed till early next year. Either way, the new Prime Minister has said, given the limited duration of his tenure, he does not have the time for what he termed political gambling.
Also on the horizon, Nauru will host the Pacific Islands Forum amid concerns about its prohibitive visa fees for journalists. The fate of hundreds of refugees and asylum seekers still hangs in the balance on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. And Bougainville continues to pursue the resurrection of its Panguna copper mine as it tries to establish some financial autonomy ahead of next year's independence referendum. This is Jamie Tahana.
Fiji's population is growing at its lowest rate in 30 years, and unemployment is the lowest recorded in 20 years. That's according to the first results of last year's census released this month by the Fijian government. Senior lecturer in economics at the University of the South Pacific, Nisha Gounder, told Sally Round he's waiting for more figures to make sense of the trends. He says the population's annual average growth rate is at 0.6%.
The two major reasons for this are the out-migration as well as the fertility rates. And the other one is the decline in unemployment, which is estimated to be around 4.5%. However, we need more information regarding unemployment data to be clear about what's going on. For instance, we need information on subsistence workers. Purely subsistence workers are regarded as employed workers. And in the 2007 census, the pure subsistence workers amounted to 21% of all employed. The other interesting aspect is the population is not reported by ethnicity. Ethnicity is important in Fiji's context. For instance, Fijians of Indian descent or Indo-Fijian, the population has continued to decline. And it'll be interesting to see what is the population in 2017. There are the other areas where ethnicity-based data is useful. For instance, keeping track of development issues of different ethnic communities, health-related policies and so on.
And will this information be brought out later, do you think? Is it unusual that all the information doesn't come out at once?
It is unusual because what we have just been given is release number one. Usually we would expect a summary of almost every aspect of the data that was collected. So it is surprising why only selected data has been reported. I'm not sure whether the data on ethnicity will be released, because this was one of the issues as to why the 2007 census was delayed, because the government did not want the data on ethnicity to be released.
Just going back to the growth in the population, 0.6% annual average, is this a worry for Fiji that the population growth is low?
It should not be at the moment, because we need to look at what's happening over time. So we need to wait and see. It's not really a concern at this stage. There is a decline in fertility rate or out migration, but we need to wait and see in 10 years' time what is the trend.
And also another figure, nearly 17% increase in the people living in urban areas. That's due to people moving from rural areas or just a higher birth rate, do you know?
Yes. So one reason is people moving from rural to urban areas. But the other reason has been an extension of urban boundaries as well, which is contributing. So it is a number of factors. But certainly what stands out is there are people moving from rural areas into urban areas.
And that would be expected, I guess, as Fiji develops?
Yes, it is not entirely surprising because the urban areas are still attractive to many people. This is where most of the jobs are, and the agriculture sector isn't doing very well. The services sector is generating most of the jobs.
What sort of policies would Fiji need based on these statistics?
Well, first of all, looking at the rate of urban population, one thing is clear is that our towns and cities are getting crowded. So the policymakers will need to look at provision of infrastructure to cater for the increasing urban population, roads, schools, hospitals, and so on. And that is the immediate policy issue. The other one that needs to be taken care of is how to make rural areas more attractive so that people live in rural areas and there is no push factors in rural areas. We have to make sure that people stay on the farms, and that would mean providing incentive for farmers to invest in farms and so on. So agriculture has been declining for some time now, and one of the reasons would be related to lease issues, for instance. So the nature of property rights needs to be looked at as well.
The World Health Organization says its new collaboration with the South Pacific Tourism Organization will promote smoke-free public places, increase opportunities for people to eat healthy, local foods, and exercise. The WHO technical officer, Ida Morisori, told Jenny Meyer the so-called Healthy Islands Project is aimed at improving the health of both the tourism workers and tourists to the region.
In fact, it will involve helping to make our tourism workforce healthier as well as provide opportunity for our tourists. I know there's a growing demand for healthy options when it comes to visits to other countries, especially in the Pacific, and so we want to support those efforts.
How will it work in practice? What are you going to implement specifically?
So actually, to begin with, WHO is hosting a workshop on tobacco-free tourism in March, and SPTO is going to be involved as well. And we're going to start working with our country counterparts on identifying ways of integrating smoke-free public places into tourism efforts and ensure that those domestic laws are enforced in order to promote this bit of health promotion. And moving forward, we'll continue to work together to work with the different sectors of government to promote and raise awareness about aspects of healthy tourism, such as, you know, increasing accessibility for persons with disabilities, both visitors and the workforce.
So it'll help the infrastructure around some of those popular tourist spots as well. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, we hope to advise and advocate to both governments and private sector about how they might be able to integrate and be aware of accessibility issues related to whether it's their hotel or their restaurant or their museum or whatever tourism site it may be, what they can possibly do to increase accessibility for persons with disabilities.
And I see, as well as that, you're looking at promoting healthy local food choices. Does that mean you're trying to look at alternatives rather than just, say, for example, fast food outlets, that kind of thing?
You know, we're very fortunate in many of the Pacific Islands to have fresh local produce and other healthy foods. And so we want to work with the South Pacific Tourism Organization to promote using healthy local foods in the restaurants across the Pacific and really showcasing the wonderful cuisine we have here in the Pacific to tourists and feature the talents of our local chefs using local foods, and that tasty food can also be healthy. Yeah.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very, very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. Also, let us know how you heard the program, if it was through PCJ Radio International or through one of our partner stations on medium wave FM or satellite. We'd definitely love to know. Anyway, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the program. Just a quick reminder that listeners in the Pacific can catch a daily three-time edition. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon.